Delicate stalactites shaped like soda straws, and heavy hooded stalagmites looming up from the cave floor. She kept pointing out formations that reminded her of a penis. "You've only been away from home 3 days," I whispered. "I didn't say it looked like JT's," she whispered back. The sound of trickling water was everywhere, even over our heads. I shivered to think how many tons of rock and dirt were up there above us. I'd forgotten that caves were not my favorite thing. The highlight of the tour was the drapery room, which was admittedly impressive in size. The guide pointed with his flashlight to various formations, which had names like Chief Cochise and the Drapes. The walls and ceiling glittered with crystallized moisture. "Then, for just a minute, they always have to do this," he turned off the lights. The darkness was absolute. I grabbed for Emelina's arm as the ceilings and walls came rushing up to my face. I felt choked by my own tongue. As I held on to Emelina and waited for the lights to come back on, I breathed slowly and tried to visualize the size of the room, the distance between myself and the roof that I knew was there. Instead, I saw random images that didn't help. Emelina collecting the little fast food cars for her boys. The man in the cafe who'd suggested I marry him. And then, while we all still waited, I understood that the terror of my recurring dream was not about losing just vision, but the whole of myself, whatever that was. What you lose in blindness is the space around you, the place where you are, and without that, you might not exist. You could be nowhere at all. Chapter 18. Ground Orientation. Lloyd and I were going to spend Christmas at Santa Rosalia Pueblo. Snow fell steadily as we drove north through the Apache Reservation. It enclosed translucent desert trees in spherical white envelopes, giving them form and substance. It was surprising to look out over a landscape that normally seemed empty and see a forest. When I closed my eyes, I saw papier-mâché peacocks. I'd been helping out on the piñata assembly lines. I'd had nightmares again and wasn't sleeping well. I figured I could be useful. We didn't turn out 500 piñatas in 10 days. That was a little ambitious. But we passed the halfway mark. The last 50 or so were the best by folk art standards. By then, we'd already used up every scrap of blue crepe paper from the attics and bureau drawers of Grace, and so had to be enterprising. Some women cut up denim jeans. Mrs. Nunez made peacock wings out of the indigo-colored fly leaves of all 12 volumes of the Compton's Children's Encyclopedia. To be sure, there were no two alike. I also sweat blood over my mimeographed broadside. I wasn't a writer, except by default. Viola refused to help, saying I was the one that went to college, so quit whining. I tried to include all the things that made Grace what it was. The sisters coming over with their peacocks. Their blue-eyed descendants planting an Eden of orchards in the idyllic days before Black Mountain. The confetti-colored houses and stair-step streets. Everything that would be lost to a poisoned river. All in one page. Viola wouldn't let me go longer, claiming nobody would read it. There was some argument over whether to put the note inside the piñata, like a message in a bottle. I said city people didn't buy art just to crack it open. I was respected as an expert on city people. So my modest history of Grace was rolled, bound in ribbon like a diploma, and inserted into each peacock's beak. The second Tucson excursion filled two chartered buses. Some husbands and kids got into the act, and also my students. I declared it a class project. I told Ramo if he sold 10 peacocks, I'd give him a C+. But I didn't go. Lloyd had asked for a week's layoff, and we set out on the trip he'd been planning forever. "Don't you have to stop somewhere and check on your roosters?" I asked. We were near White River. "I don't have any roosters." "You don't?" I was incredulous. I thought he'd just stop going to fights himself.
What? You sold them?
Golly Bluestone kinda took over the business. So you could get back into it if you wanted to. Nope. He's moved over to the Colorado River Reservation. He's fighting them over at Ehrenberg. This was a good bit more frightening to me than if Lloyd had presented me with a diamond ring. But, I said, I'm not... What if you and I don't work out, Lloyd? He downshifted for a rutted trench in the road. No offense, Cody, but I didn't give up cockfighting to impress you. I did it because you were right.
I was right?
About what you said.
What did I say?
He didn't answer. I vaguely remembered saying something about puncture wounds and internal hemorrhage, making that a spectator sport. I can't believe you'd do this thing all your life and then just quit one day after something I said. Maybe you were ready to give it up anyway.
Maybe I was.
We were both quiet for a while, passing through winter-killed fields of grass and sage. Two black horses grazed on bristly shrubs in a field with no apparent fences.
You and your brother were twins, right? I asked, apropos of nothing.
He nodded. Identical. Twins are bad luck. I laughed.
For the mother?
No, in the pueblo. When twins are born, people say there'll be a poor rainy season or grasshoppers or some darn thing. In the old days, you had to let twins die.
Both? You couldn't pick one and let the other one go?
Nope. I can't imagine the mother who'd do it, I said, though of course I could. I had probably starved my own child to death in utero rather than risk known disaster.
There's a Tiwa story about a mother sneaking her twins out of the pueblo and leaving them with spider grandmother to raise.
Yeah, see, if there was a story like that, people knew it was wrong to let them die.
Knew it was hard, not wrong necessarily. When Leander and I were bat, our mother said she was like poor old spider grandmother, got stuck with the war twins.
Were you bat a lot?
Just twice as bad as a regular boy. He laughed. People called us twice as bad.
Our sisters talked about us like we were just one boy. They'd say, he went out riding or whatever. I think we thought we were one person. One boy in two skins.
Hallie and I feel that way sometimes.
I could see clear crescents of water collecting on Lloyd's lower eyelids.
You don't have to talk about this, I said.
I don't ever talk about him. Sometimes I'll go a day or two without even thinking about him, and then I get scared I might forget he ever was.
I laid a hand on his gear shift arm. You want me to drive?
He stopped and turned off the engine. We sat watching snowflakes hit the windshield and turn into identical dots of water. Then he got out. I pulled on my mittens and followed him. Outside the cab, it was impossibly quiet. We'd climbed a little now and were in forest. Snowflakes hissed against pine needles. Jack sat in the truck bed watching Lloyd carefully, exhaling voiceless clouds of steam.
"I ever tell you how I came to keep Jack?" Lloyd asked.
I thought about it.
"No. You told me how you took in his mother and she had pups. You didn't say how you picked Jack."
"He picked us." Lloyd was leaning against the truck with his arms crossed over his chest. He looked cold.
"Dad meant to drown the whole litter. He put them in an empty cement bag and tied the top real good and drove down to the river and pitched them in.
He didn't know what he was doing. He was drunk as $7,000, I imagine. On the way back, he picked me up from work and I said, 'Dad, here's one of the pups in the back of the truck.' He was hiding down in a box of pipe tea joints. Dad's old truck was a junkyard on wheels. You could find anything in the world back there. So I says to Dad, 'Where's the rest of them?'"
Lloyd's voice caught, and he waited a second, wiping his eyes.
"I don't know what I'm getting all broke up for. God knows what I would have done with seven mongrel coyote pups."
I thought to myself, God knows what I'd have done with a baby at 16. It's not the practical side of things that breaks us up. I leaned on the truck beside him and took his left hand between my mittened palms. It felt like a cold bottle. So what happened? Why did you lose Leander?
Why?
He looked up at the sky. Because we left the Pueblo. We were like the war twins, I guess. A lot for our mother to handle. Our sisters were all older and having their own babies by that time, and people thought boys should go out in the world some. Be with our dad. He'd been down at White River more or less as long as we could remember. If we'd stayed up there in Santa Rosalia, it would have worked out, but we came down here and Leander just ran into trouble. We didn't have anybody looking after us. Dad couldn't look after himself.
Doesn't sound like it, I said.
Everybody always talked like Leander died of drinking, but he wasn't but 15. Not old enough to sit down and order a beer. Everybody forgets that he was just a kid. We drank some, but I don't think he was drinking the night he died. There was a fight in a bar.
What did he die of then?
Puncture wounds. Internal hemorrhage. I drove through the pine forest, thinking off and on of Hallie, mindful of the slick road. Lloyd was quiet, but took the wheel again when we descended into the Navajo reservation. He pointed out areas that were overgrazed. It seems as big as the whole world, but it's still a reservation, he said. There's fences, and a sheep can't cross them. As dusk took us, the landscape changed to an eerie flat desert overseen by godheads of red sandstone. We were out of the snow now. The hills were striped with pinks and reds that deepened as we drove north and the sun drove west. It was dark when we left the highway and made our way down a bumpy road into the mouth of Canyon de Chelly. We passed several signs proclaiming the canyon bottom to be Navajo tribal land, where only authorized persons were admitted. The third sign, sternly luminous in the headlights, said, "Third and final warning."
"Are we allowed in here?" I asked.
"Stick with me. I can get you into all the best places." Down in the canyon, we bumped over rough road for an hour, following the course of a shallow river. There was no moon that I could see, and I lost any sense of direction I might have had while we still had sun. I was exhausted, but also for the first time in weeks, I felt sleepiness. That rare, delicious liqueur soaking into my body like blotter paper. I almost fell asleep sitting up. My head bobbed as we crossed and recrossed the frozen river and climbed its uneven banks. Finally, we stopped and slept in the truck bed, cuddled like twin mummies inside a thick wrapping of blankets. We turned our bodies carefully and held each other to keep warm. Outside the blankets, our lips and noses were like chipped flint striking sparks in the frozen air.
"No fair. You've got Jack on your side," I murmured.
"Jack, other side, boy," Lloyd commanded. Jack stood up and walked over the cocoon that contained us, stepping carefully on our chests. He turned around a few times in the wedge of space behind me, then dropped down with a groan and snuggled against my back. Within minutes, I could feel the extra heat, and I fell into heaven-sent unconsciousness. In the morning, a sugar coating of snow had fallen, lightly covering the rocks. Ahead of us, the canyon forked into two. From the riverbed, a red rock spire rose 1,000 feet into the air. Low clouds or high fog brushed its top. I held my breath. Looking up at a rock like that gave me the heady sensation of heights. He'd parked, so this would be the first thing I saw, Spider Rock. The canyon walls rose straight up on either side of us, ranging from sunset orange to deep rust mottled with purple. The sandstone had been carved by ice ages and polished by desert eons of sandpaper winds. The place did not so much inspire religion as it seemed to be religion itself. I was dressed in an instant and walking around awestruck like a kid. My head bent all the way back. "It doesn't look like a spider," I said of the rock. "It looks like a steeple."
"Is named for Spider Woman. She lived up there a long time ago."
One day she lassoed two Navajo ladies with her web and pulled them up there and taught them how to weave rugs. The thought of standing on top of that rock, let alone trying to learn anything up there, made me shiver. Is that the same spider grandmother who raised the twins? I expected Lloyd to be impressed by my memory, but he just nodded. That's a Pueblo story, and this is a Navajo story, but it's the same spider woman. Everybody kind of agrees on the important stuff. I shaded my eyes and looked up the canyon. Its narrows gave window views into its wider places. Giant buttresses of rock extended from the canyon walls like ships, complete with knobbly figureheads standing on their prows. Some of the figureheads had been stranded, eroded away from the mother rock, and stood alone as sculptured spires. Where the canyon grew narrower, the rock buttresses alternated like baffles, so the river had to run a slalom course around them. So did we. The truck crunched over icy shoals and passed through crystal tunnels of icy cottonwood branches. We passed a round hogan with a shingled roof and a line of smoke rising from its chimney pipe. A horse wandered nearby, nosing among the frozen leaves. Several times Lloyd stopped to point out ancient pictures cut in the rock. They tended to be in clusters, as if seeking refuge from loneliness in that great mineral expanse. There were antelope, snakes, and ducks in a line like a carnival shooting gallery, and humans, oddly turtle-shaped, with their arms out and fingers splayed as if in surrender or utter surprise. The petroglyphs added in recent centuries showed more svelte, self-assured men riding horses. The march of human progress seemed mainly a matter of getting over that initial shock of being here. Eventually, we stopped in a protected alcove of rock where no snow had fallen. The walls sloped inward over our heads, and long dark marks like rust stains ran parallel down the cliff face at crazy angles. When I looked straight up, I lost my sense of gravity. The ground under my boots was dry red sand, soft and fine, weathered down from the stone. If the river rose to here, the mud would be red. Lloyd held my shoulders and directed my eyes to the opposite wall, a third of the way up. Facing the morning sun was a village built into the cliff. It was like Kanishba, the same multi-story apartments and unbelievably careful masonry. The walls were shaped to fit the curved hole in the cliff, and the building blocks were cut from the same red rock that served as their foundation. I thought of what Lloyd had told me about Pueblo architecture, whose object was to build a structure the earth could embrace. This looked more than embraced. It reminded me of cliff swallow nests, or mud dauber nests, or crystal gardens sprung from their own matrix, the perfect constructions of nature. Prehistoric condos, I said. Lloyd nodded. Same people, but a lot older. They were here when Columbus's folks were still rubbing two sticks together. How in the world did they get up there? Lloyd pointed out a crack that zigzagged up from the talus slope to the ledge where the village perched. In places, the crevice wasn't more than 2 inches deep. They were pretty good rock climbers, he said. Lloyd's forte was understatement. There wasn't a sound except for the occasional echoing pop of a small falling rock. What were they scared of? I asked quietly. I don't know. Maybe they weren't scared. Maybe they liked the view. The doors were built so you'd have to step high to get out. Obviously for the sake of the children. Gives you the willies, doesn't it? I asked. The thought of raising kids in a place where the front yard ends in a 200-foot drop? No worse than raising up kids where the front yard ends in a freeway. You're right, I said. No worse than that. And quieter. Less carbon monoxide. So you do think about that sometimes, Lloyd said. About what? Being a mother. I glanced at him and considered several possible answers. All the time, and never, seemed equally true. Sometimes I wanted to say, you had your chance, Lloyd. We had our baby, and it's dead. but I didn't. That was my past, not his.
Sure, I think about it, I said, needing to relieve the pressure in my chest. I think about hot-wiring a Porsche and driving to Mexico, too. He laughed. Only one of the two is legal, I'm told.
I wanted to try and climb up into the Cliff Village, but Lloyd explained that we'd crack our skulls. Plus, you weren't supposed to mess with the antiquities.
I thought you broke all the rules, I said, as we climbed back into the truck and headed farther up the canyon.
He looked surprised. What rules have I broken?
Authorized Navajo personnel only, for starters. We're not even supposed to be down here.
We are authorized guests of Maxine Shorty of the Streams Come Together clan.
Does she live here?
Not now. Almost everybody drives their sheep out and spends a winter up top, but the farms are down here. Leander and I spent almost every summer here till we were 13.
You did? Doing what?
Working.
I'll show you.
Who's Maxine Shorty?
My aunt. I'd like you to meet her, but she's down visiting at Window Rock for the holiday.
Lloyd was full of surprises.
I'll never get your family straight. How'd you get a Navajo aunt? Are Navajos and Pueblos all one big tribe or something?
Lloyd laughed rather hysterically. It occurred to me that this redneck Apache former cockfighter must find me, at times, an outstanding bonehead.
The Pueblo people were always here, he explained patiently. They're still building houses just like this, the Rio Grande Pueblos, Zuni, Hopi Mesa, not in the cliffs anymore, but otherwise just the same. They're about the only Indians that haven't been moved off their own place into somebody else's.
And the Navajo?
Navajos and Apaches are a bunch that came down from Canada not that long ago. A few hundred years, maybe, looking for someplace warmer.
And this is now Navajo tribal land because?
Because the U.S. government officially gave it to them. Wasn't that nice? Too bad they didn't give them the Golden Gate Bridge, too.
The truck crunched over frozen sand.
So, I said, the Pueblo are homebodies, and the Navajo and Apache are wanderers.
You could look at it that way, I guess.
What are you?
Pueblo.
There was no hesitation.
What are you? He asked.
I have no idea. My mother came from someplace in Illinois, and Doc Homer won't own up to being from anywhere. I can't remember half of what happened to me before I was 15. I guess I'm nothing. I'm the nothing tribe.
Homebody tribe or wanderer tribe?
I laughed. Emelina called me a homewrecker one time. Or no, what did she say? A home ignorer.
He didn't respond to that.
So how'd you get a Navajo aunt? I asked again.
The usual way. My mother's brother married her. Pueblo men have to marry out of the clan, and sometimes they go off the Pueblo. The land down here stays with the women, so my uncle came here.
Maxine Shorty's farm, which she inherited from her mother and would pass on to her daughters, was a triangle bordered by the river and the walls of a short side canyon. We parked by the line of cottonwoods near the river and walked over the icy stubble of a cornfield. A sad scarecrow stood guard. It occurred to me that the barrenness of a winter farm was deceptive. Everything was there. It was still fertile, just as surely as trees held their identity in the shape and swell of their bare winter twigs.
Has it changed much?
I meant it as a joke. I saw nothing that could have changed, but Lloyd looked around carefully.
Those little weedy cottonwoods have grown up along the stream, and there's a big boulder on that slope. You see the one with dark stripes? That used to be up there.
He pointed to a place in the canyon wall, visible only to himself, from which the boulder had fallen.
Most men, I thought, aren't this familiar with the furniture in their homes.
So what did you do here?
Worked our butts off. Weeded, picked corn, grew beans and watermelons, and had to carry a lot of water in the bad years.
Were those peach trees here? I asked.
A weathered orchard occupied the steep upper section of land. They're older than my aunt. The peach trees go way back. They were planting orchards down here 300 years ago.
A canyon of fruit, like grace, He inspected the trees carefully, one at a time, the bases of the branches, the trunks, the ends of twigs. I didn't know what he was looking for, and didn't ask. It seemed like family business. On this land, Lloyd seemed like a family man.
And did the people that lived up in the cliffs grow corn and beans too? I asked.
That's right.
So how come this canyon stayed productive for 1,000 and some odd years, and we can't even live in grace for 1 century without screwing it up?
It was mostly a rhetorical question, but Lloyd considered it for a long time as he led me along a path up the talus slope to the back of the Box Canyon.
I know the answer to that, he said finally, but I can't put it in words. I'll have to show you. Not here. Later on.
I felt sadly let down, though it was closer to an actual promise of revelation than I'd gotten in 9 years of watching Carlo's eyebrows. I could wait for later on. At the top of the slope was another ancient dwelling, this one mainly just ruined walls. The floor plan was clear. It interested me that the doors all lined up, I suppose to admit light to the interior.
I found a whole clay pot in here one time, Lloyd said. It's in my mother's house.
He lowered his voice.
Don't tell any Navajos. They'll throw Mama in jail.
You brought it back to her at the end of one summer, right? As a present, and she still treasures it. He smiled a little shyly. The image of a 10-year-old Lloyd brought the threat of tears to my eyes. I'd spent my life watching mother-child rituals from outside the window.
So you played in here when you were little?
Oh, yeah.
This used to be me and Leander's fort.
Cowboys and Indians?
He laughed. Good Indians and bad Indians.
Which were you?
Nobody can be good all the time or bad all the time. We took turns.
He led me over a couple of tumble-down walls to the base of the cliff and knelt down. I looked where he pointed. Set carefully among an assortment of old petroglyphs were 2 modern ones, the outlined left hands of 2 small boys, just touching, perfectly matched. We crossed the high desert from Chinle to Shiprock, New Mexico, and on to the Hemis Mountains. Wind battered the windows and we warmed our hands at the heater vents and talked about everything under the sun. Lloyd talked about his marriage to Sissy Ramon, which he said was noisy and short. Sissy was crazy about rooster fighting, men, and unusual colors of nail polish like green. He thought she was exotic, but she was just wild. There was a difference. She ran out on him. He was a good deal more interested in talking about working in his aunt's pecan orchards in Grace. This aunt was his mother's sister, Sonia. She married a Pueblo man from her village but moved with him to Grace when Black Mountain drafted Native American men into the mines during World War II. Sonia and her husband planted fruit trees there, thinking the war would last at least 20 years. And when it didn't, they felt they ought to stay on in Grace anyway, for the sake of the orchards. It was a different story from farming in Canyon de Chelly, Lloyd said. Sonia had started out as a tenant picker before buying her own pecan orchard, and she learned harvesting the modern way. Usually the harvest started in October and ran till Thanksgiving. To get the nuts off the trees, they used a machine called a tree shaker. I told him I remembered guys hitting the branches with sticks when I was a kid.
Nah, we were high-tech. After the tree shaker comes the harvester, which is this big thing with a vacuum scooper that you drive along between the rows. It scoops up everything and blows the sticks and leaves out the back, and the pecans and rocks fall down into this cage at the bottom. More junk falls out the slots as it rolls around, and the hulls fall off, and the idea is you end up with mostly pecans. But really, you end up with pecans and pecan-sized dirt clods and pecan-sized rocks.
So did you get to drive the big machines?
Nope. Mostly I got to pick rocks and dirt clods off the conveyor. I think that was the best job I ever had. The hardest but the best, because I grew up on it. Stopped thinking about myself all the time and started thinking about something else.
even if it was just damn pecans. I took it from Lloyd's use of the singular pronoun that Leander was dead by this time. Slowly, I was patching together Lloyd's life, and it was not the poor little gypsy story I'd imagined. I suppose I'd wanted to see him as a fellow orphan. But everywhere he'd been with family. "How long will Grace last without the river?" I asked. 2 or 3 years, maybe. The old orchards will go longer because their roots are deeper. He glanced at me. "You know I have an orchard?"
"No."
"In Grace?"
"Yep.
Not the pecans. Those belong to my cousins. But Tia Sonia's leaving me the peach orchard. The fruit trees were always my job, keeping the birds and squirrels off the fruit."
"How do you do that?"
"Well, the main way is by killing them." I laughed.
"What's funny?"
"I don't know." I stared out the windshield. In the distance, Shiprock floated like a ghost vessel on the snowy plain. "So now you have a dying orchard to call your own. Your Aunt Sonia's moved back to Santa Rosalia, right?"
"Right.
But the orchard's not mine till I have kids."
"That doesn't seem fair."
"No, it makes sense. When you have a family, you need trees." He paused, carefully it seemed to me, and redirected the conversation. "What job did you grow up on?" I thought this over. "Maybe I haven't had it yet." He smiled. "You went to medical school, right? And almost finished. That can't be too easy."
When it stopped being easy, I quit.
"What were you doing in Tucson then, before you came to Grace?"
"You don't want to know. Cashier in a 7-Eleven.
"Shoot, and I thought you were too good to go out with a locomotive engineer. What about before that?"
"You don't want to know."
"Yes, I do."
"Well, I did medical research at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota."
"Damn, really?"
"Yep. I was living up there 2 years ago when I first found out Doc Homer was sick."
"And before that?"
I rolled my head back and looked at the roof of the car. "You really don't want to know."
"You were president of the United States?"
"Guess again."
"You hot-wired Porsches?"
I laughed.
"The biggest thing I ever stole was a frozen lobster for my boyfriend's birthday. I was working in frozen foods, and I think I actually wanted to get fired. Doesn't that sound stupid?"
"Yes, it sounds stupid.
So that came before Mayo Clinic?"
"That and a bunch of different odd little things. A few piddly research jobs in between. Believe me, I never put everything on the same resume."
"And what's the one you never mention? The one you're trying not to tell me about?"
"For a few years in there, I lived overseas."
"No kidding. Did you fly? Shoot, I'd love to go someplace in an airplane."
"Flying's okay," I said. In truth, flying terrified me. It's the one thing I knew I had in common with my mother, who'd flat out refused there at the end. In my own life, I handled it by means of steadfast denial. I'd flown over the Atlantic Ocean twice without even checking to see if there really was a flotation device under my seat. Flotation seemed beside the point. Oh, I flew like a bird.
"So, okay, what were you doing overseas?"
I glanced at him.
"I was my boyfriend Carlo's girlfriend on the island of Crete."
He seemed amused.
"What, you mean you cleaned house and made cookies?"
"Kind of. Sometimes I'd help out in the clinic.
One time I set the broken leg of a sheep.
But mostly I was a housewife."
"So you'd what, go shopping in a bikini?"
I laughed. "It really was not that kind of island. You know where it is, right? In between Greece and Egypt? The women wear black wool dresses and crucifixes the size of a hood ornament. Getting the picture?" He nodded. "The main baby present for a boy is a silver knife, which they present in the ceremony where the godparents list all the enemies of the family going back to around Adam and Eve."
"You liked it that much, huh?"
I took my coat off. It was finally warming up.
"Well, it was interesting. It was some place to go. It was like going to another century, actually, but I felt like a complete outsider."
I closed my eyes, fighting an old ache. How do you mean?
I'm pretty good at languages, but I never could get the hang of fitting in. Not anywhere, but especially not there.
Why do you think you don't fit in? Give me an example.
It was plain that I'd always been an oddity in Greece, so he must have meant how was I an oddity in Crete.
Well, I said, my first day there, I marched into the bakery and asked for a psoli. The word for loaf of bread is psomi. A psoli is a penis.
Lloyd laughed. Anybody could make a mistake like that.
Not more than once, I promise you.
Well, you were foreign. People expect you to say a few dumb things.
Oh, every day I did something wrong. They had complicated rules about who could talk to who and what you could say and who said it first. Like, there were all these things you were supposed to do to avoid the evil eye.
How do you do that? He asked.
Lloyd was full of curiosity.
You wear this little amulet that looks like a blue eyeball. But the main thing is you never, ever mention anything you're proud of. It's this horrible social error to give somebody a compliment because you're attracting the attention of the evil eye. So you say everything backward. When two mothers pass each other on the road carrying their babies, one says to the other, "Ugly baby," and the other one says, "Yours also."
Lloyd laughed a wonderful loud laugh that made me think of Fenton Lee in high school, who died in the train wreck.
I swear to God, it's true.
I believe you. It's just funny how people are. People in Greece do that, too, in a way. You give them a compliment and they'll say, "Oh, no, that's just something I've had a long time." We're all scared to be too happy about what we've got for fear somebody'll notice and take it away.
He reached over and stroked the underside of my arm from the elbow up. Like you, Cody. You're exactly like that. Scared to claim anything you love.
Am I?
I was willing to believe whatever he said. Talking with Lloyd was like talking to myself, only more honest. Emelina was always asking me what it was like to live overseas, and I knew she would love the penis story, but I'd never told her much about Crete. I was afraid of her seeing me as more of an outsider in Greece than I already was. But Lloyd didn't make those judgments. I could have told Lloyd I'd lived on Neptune, and he'd say, "Uh-huh. What was it like? Was it cold?" In the Hemis Mountains, we drove up the slope of what looked like a huge old volcano. A fluted core of granite jutted from its mouth, and twisted black ridges of old lava flows ran like varicose veins down its sides. The snow was deep, and the road icy. We crept along, then stopped. Lloyd got out of the truck and started down the bank toward a frozen creek that cut between the road and the steep mountainside.
"Are you nuts?" I inquired.
"Come on," he waved energetically.
"Why should I follow you down there?" I demanded, following as fast as I could.
"It's a surprise."
It was near sunset, near or below freezing, and Lloyd wasn't even wearing his jacket. I slipped several times behind him, and then we both slid flat out down the hill on our backs. We were sledding, not on snow, but on an exposed hillside of bizarre rounded gravel. I picked up a handful in my mitten and tossed it in the air. It was porous and weightless like styrofoam popcorn.
"What is this stuff?" I asked.
But Lloyd was already crossing a log over the frozen creek. I scrambled behind him up the forested slope on the other side. I picked my way between rocks, grabbing roots and tree trunks to pull myself up. Halfway up, I had to stop, hugging a pine tree and panting. The cold air cut my lungs, and I blinked hard against the sensation that the water in my eyes might freeze over.
"It's the altitude," I whined.
Lloyd grabbed my hand and pulled me gently uphill. Suddenly, we were following the course of an odd, unfrozen stream, with lush plants thriving alongside it, their leaves glossy green against the snow. I'd never seen anything like this in nature, only in the sort of paintings that show improbable and dreamlike things. Lloyd, who had gotten ahead of me again, was now taking off his shirt. I wondered if perhaps I was, after all, in one of my strange dreams,
and whether I would soon be looking under the foliage beside the stream for my lost baby. I climbed over the top of a boulder, and there stood Lloyd, naked, smiling, an apparition bathed in steam. He slid into the blue pool at the base of the boulder. I touched the steaming water, and it blessedly scalded my fingertips. I undressed more quickly than I probably have in my life, before or since, and immersed myself up to my eyes. The sun set. Venus opened her eye on the horizon. From where we sat, we could see the Hemis Range and the valley floor 50 miles to the south, its buttes and mesas still lit by a distant sun. When our bodies turned red, we stood up briefly among the snow-covered boulders, shouting, and the steam rose off our uplifted arms like smokestacks. Lloyd asked, "So, am I nuts?" I stretched my legs along the sandy bottom of the pool until my toes found his. The heat relaxed every muscle and sinew and reflex in my body, and most of the ones in my head. This kind of happiness was sure to attract the attention of the evil eye. "Have you got any more surprises?" I asked. "Or is this the last one?" "I got some more." He scooted over and lifted me off the sand, supporting my floating body with both hands under the small of my back. "I don't give them away all at once, though," he said. "Only half a dozen a year." I counted on my fingers. Kanishba, Spider Rock, the Cliff House, and Maxine Shorty's farm. And this, Volcanic Hot Springs. I didn't know whether to count the cockfights or not. That he could give up cockfights, I'd have to count that. "So I've used up my half dozen already," I said. He lifted me slightly out of the water and kissed my ribs, one at a time. "If you're only staying around for a year, that's the rules." "That's bribery." "Whatever it takes." He kissed my navel and the damp hill over my pubic bone. The front of my body was very cold and the back was very hot. Somewhere in the middle, near my heart, I was just right. I opened my eyes and saw constellations whose names were their own business. "Were you ever in love with my sister?" I asked. He looked at me oddly. "It's just a joke. Every man I've ever been with, it seems like, was really in love with Hallie." "I can't picture your sister. She's shorter than you, right?" I ducked my chin a little, immersing my smile. Right then, I could have signed on for life. The day we left Grace, there had been 4 airmail letters in the P.O. box. Lately, Hallie's letters sometimes came in bunches, owing to the accumulated pauses in postal service between Chinandega and Grace. But I saved them and read only one per day. It supported the pleasant false notion that she was available to me all the time and would always be there tomorrow. The 4th day of our trip was Christmas Eve. In the morning, as we drove down from Hemis, before we arrived in Santa Rosalia, I laid out all 4 letters on the dash in order of postmark and spent one last hour with my sister. I reread the old ones before opening the 4th one. Hallie's week had gone wildly up and down. On Tuesday, she was nigh unto manic because the government had had a successful national meeting on the pesticide problem. Central America was becoming a toilet bowl of agricultural chemicals, she said, because of war-strained farming economies and dumping from the First World. In the 70s, when Nicaragua was run by the U.S. Marines and Somoza, it was the world's number one consumer of DDT. But it seemed the new Nicaragua, our government, she called it, planned to take responsibility for its poisons. She also mentioned that her friend Julio was back in Chinandega after a stint of literacy work near the Atlantic coast. I couldn't read anything between the lines. On Wednesday, a child was rushed in from the village of San Manuel to the Chinandega clinic in critical condition because someone had stored paraquat in a Coke bottle. On Thursday, she was grimly happy. Five Contras were making a secret sabotage raid on a hydroelectric plant somewhere to the east and were surprised by some armed farmers who took them captive. The culprits had passed through town in the back of an open jeep, slit-eyed with dishonor, on their way to trial in Managua. Wouldn't it be something, she mused, if that jeep hit one of the Contra road mines? But there was the driver to consider. And even if there hadn't been, it wasn't something she could wish for. She said, "You can't let your heart go bad like that, like sour milk. There's always the chance you'll want to use it later." I wondered at what point I'd given up on later and let mine go sour. I didn't know, although Hallie might. I reread each of the three letters with fascination, but also the same dissatisfaction I'd had on the morning I'd opened it. It was all just things happening, and selfishly, I wanted Hallie. Even if she didn't speak to me directly, I wanted her to speak. I tore open the last envelope and was hit full in the face with what I wanted. It was 4 pages long, in a cursive enlarged by rage. "When God wants to punish you," as Isak Dinesen declared, "he answers your prayers." "I am like God, Cody? Like God? Give me a break. If I get another letter that mentions saving the world, I am sending you, by return mail, a letter bomb. Cody, please. I've got things to do." "You say you're not a moral person. What a cop-out. Sometime when I wasn't looking, something happened to make you think you were bad. What, did Miss Calder give you a bad mark on your report card? You think you're no good, so you can't do good things. Jesus, Cody, how long are you going to keep limping around on that crutch? It's the other way around. It's what you do that makes you who you are. I'm sorry to be blunt. I've had a bad week. I am trying to explain, and I wish you were here so I could tell you this right now. I am trying to explain to you that I'm not here to save anybody or anything. It's not some perfect ideal we're working toward that keeps us going. You ask, what if we lose this war? Well, we could. By invasion or even in the next election. People are very tired. I don't expect to see perfection before I die. Lord, if I did, I would have stuck my head in the oven back in Tucson after hearing the stories of some of those refugees. What keeps you going isn't some fine destination, but just the road you're on and the fact that you know how to drive. You keep your eyes open, you see this damn-to-hell world you got born into, and you ask yourself, what life can I live that will let me breathe in and out and love somebody or something and not run off screaming into the woods? I didn't look down from some high rock and choose cotton fields in Nicaragua. These cotton fields chose me. The Contras that were through here yesterday got sent to a prison farm where they'll plant vegetables. Learn to read and write if they don't know how, learn to repair CB radios, and get a week-long vacation with their families every year. They'll probably get amnesty in 5. There's hardly ever a repeat offender. That kid from San Manuel died. Your sister, Hallie. "What's new with Hallie?" Lloyd asked. "Nothing." I folded the pages back into the envelope as neatly as I could, trying to leave its creases undisturbed, but my fingers had gone numb and blind. With tears in my eyes, I watched whatever lay to the south of us, the land we were driving down into, but I have no memory of it. I was getting a dim comprehension of the difference between Hallie and me. It wasn't a matter of courage or dreams, but something a whole lot simpler. A pilot would call it ground orientation. I'd spent a long time circling above the clouds, looking for life, while Hallie was living it. Chapter 19. The Bread Girl. 5 miles outside of Santa Rosalia Pueblo, Lloyd stopped the truck, pulled off his cowboy boots, and put on moccasins. Shortly, we were going to have to get out and walk through snow. "Saving your boots?" I asked. He ignored me. Those particular boots looked as though they'd hitchhiked to hell and back without getting a single ride.
Me and Leander used to come home at the end of the summer wearing cowboy boots, and Mama would have a fit and cowboy hats. She'd grab off our hats and swat us with them and say, "Ah, you look like Navajos."
I'd never seen Lloyd wear a hat of any kind, now that I thought about it. His story brought back a memory, vague and incomplete, of cowboy boots and a hat I'd had myself as a child. I could just recall the sheen of lacquered straw and a terrible sadness.
"You see it yet?"
I squinted toward the south, but saw only snow-covered hills dotted with dark, spherical juniper bushes. The horizon was punctuated with bleak mesas whose rock shoulders stood exposed to the cold.
"See what?"
"Where we're going to sleep tonight."
"I hope not."
A few minutes later, he asked again. I saw mesas and scalped hills with rocky outcroppings on their tops. I saw juniper trees and snow.
"Is this an eye test?" I asked.
We were practically inside Santa Rosalia Pueblo before I saw it. The village was built on a mesa and blended perfectly with the landscape, constructed of the same stones as the outcroppings that topped all the other empty mesas. Horses and broad-faced cattle looked up at us from their pens as Lloyd's red truck, the newest-looking thing within 100 miles, rolled up the dirt track into town. It was a village of weathered rectangles, some stacked stepwise in twos and threes, the houses all blending into one another around a central plaza. The stone walls were covered with adobe plaster, smooth and appealing as mud pies, a beautiful brown town. The color brown, I realized, is anything but nondescript. It comes in as many hues as there are colors of earth, which is commonly presumed infinite. We left the truck in the company of other pickups and station wagons at the edge of town and walked up into the narrow streets. In his moccasins, Lloyd walked with a softer, less aggressive gait. Jack stayed close to his left knee. There wasn't a soul out, but lines of smoke drifted from chimneys and the big adobe beehive ovens that squatted in every third or fourth backyard. A black dog pawed at the edge of a frozen puddle. The ladders that connected one rooftop to the next were drifted lightly with snow. One house had a basketball hoop nailed to the end beams. Front curtains everywhere glowed with warm interior light, though it was still early afternoon, and strings of bright red chilies hung by the front doors. Lloyd's mother's house had a green door. The front window was crowded with artificial flowers and ceramic animals. Lloyd's oldest sister, Birdie, met us at the door. The two of them spoke rapidly in a language that sounded like song, as if the pitch might be as important as the syllable. Birdie had a perm and wore a large turquoise necklace over her flowered blouse. She stopped talking to Lloyd just long enough to touch my arm and say, "He still has that dog, don't he? And come get warm." We followed her into the kitchen, where Lloyd's mother enveloped him with a hug, then tugged his ponytail and lightly boxed his ears.
"What's she saying?" I asked Birdie.
"She's saying he looks like a Navajo." The kitchen smelled of cedar smoke. Inez Peregrina was cooking a goose, among other things. She wore a large dress composed of about 6 different cotton fabrics, florals and plaids, somehow colorfully harmonic. The frames of her glasses were large and owlish. Her gray hair was trimmed in bangs and a page boy over her ears, but long in back, twisted into a heavy, complicated coil and tied with red cloth. Her hands were noticeably large. I wanted her to hug me, too, but she only smiled and touched my cheek when Lloyd introduced us. She continued talking to him in a steady musical downpour, to which he was attentive. Birdie disappeared and soon returned at the head of a flock of women, and I was introduced. But the conversation between Inez and Lloyd went on, uninterrupted. One at a time, each of the other women held out both hands to me, which I took, trying to appear gracious while I struggled to get their positions straight. They were Lloyd's sisters, a niece, his Aunt Sonia, who had lived in Grace during the war and after, and someone Lloyd called his naval mother. I couldn't discern the generations. Aunt Sonia spoke to me in Spanish and poured cups of coffee for Lloyd and me from a huge tin pot on the wood-fired stove. There were also a propane stove and the adobe oven in the backyard, and all three were in use. I felt spectacularly out of place. For one thing, I stood a foot taller than any other woman in the room. We don't even have to get into matters of wardrobe. But I was also fascinated to watch Lloyd being his mother's son, his sister's brother, the apple of the family eye, the only remaining boy. The sisters asked him in calm, uninflected English about the drive and the length of our stay and whether he'd seen Aunt Maxine, who evidently had a heart condition. Aunt Sonia asked several specific questions about people in Grace, some of whom I knew better than Lloyd because of my Stitch and Bitch association, but I was reluctant to speak. She and the sisters drifted away to other tasks, and Inez still hadn't stopped talking. "Is it okay if I look around?" I asked Lloyd. "You can dance on the table if you want to. You're the guest," he said, grabbing me around the waist. "I don't want to dance on the table." He held on to me for just a minute, asking Inez in English what she thought of me. I passed a hand through my hair, thankful that it had had time to grow out from Billy Idol to a more or less regulation Mary Martin. Inez smiled and said something, running the ladle in her right hand up and down an imaginary line. I looked at Lloyd for translation. "She says I'm lucky to have gotten such a big, strong girl. She thinks I'm lazy." "Tell her I don't put up with lazy men. I make them pull their weight," he told her, and she laughed, giving me the hug I'd coveted. The frosted window panes looked out onto the cold plain and dish-shaped empty cornfields that lay to the south, but the kitchen was smoky and warm. The open pantry behind Inez was stocked with jars of dry yellow corn, cans of Spam, and fruit cocktail. No orchards here, evidently. And hominy. In Grace, it was golden jars of home-canned peach halves that sat smug on kitchen shelves. Here, it was puffy white hominy, jar after jar of it. Hominy enough for an army. The kitchen was at the end of a big room that contained a long wooden table, a sofa, numerous small chests, and many, many photos. A radio in another room played Hank Williams. I moved around the living room, idly looking out the windows and examining photographs. There was one of Inez and a man I presumed to be Lloyd's father standing together in formal dress. He in silver-buttoned moccasins and a royal blue velvet shirt. Inez in turquoise bracelets and a silver squash blossom necklace over her dark ceremonial dress. Her legs looked like white birch stumps in their buckskin leggings, and the woven blanket folded across her shoulders seemed to weigh her down. She looked much older than she must have actually been. Most of the available tabletops were populated by little ceramic animals of the pastel cute variety. Lloyd had told me Inez made the best pottery in the Pueblo, but evidently it was made for Anglo collectors, not for home use. I did find in a china cabinet a display of extraordinary black and white pots, their glazed surfaces covered with microscopically fine geometric designs. Some of the pots were slightly less well made, maybe some of the proud early efforts of Inez's daughters. A crude, dark bowl with a chipped rim sat in the cabinet's central place of honor, and I stared at it, puzzled, until I realized this was Lloyd's pot, the one he'd found in the ruins, Lloyd's offering from Canyon de Chelly. I peeked into the next room. Charlie Rich was singing from the radio now, and Bertie hummed behind closed doors while she bent over an electric sewing machine. Its small light glowed on her face. A baby slept on a flat, fur-lined cradle board that hung like a swing on ropes from the ceiling. On every fifth arc of the swing, Bertie reached up without looking and gave it a push. She noticed me standing in the doorway and inclined her head toward the end of the room, where an iron bed stood behind a drawn-open curtain of blankets. "You can put things there. That's for you and Lloyd."
"Thanks," I said.